This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. In a sports writing career covering half a century, Hal McCoy crowns his own Hall of Fame career with his latest book, The Real McCoy, My Half Century with the Cincinnati Reds. The memoir of the team gives fans an inside-the-dugout look that never made the daily press. Veteran sports writer Hal McCoy and WVXU political reporter and avid baseball fan Howard Wilkinson join us to discuss the book, Hal McCoy's years covering the Reds and what really happened to Sparky. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. What really did happen to Sparky?
He died.
Unfortunately, he did.
Yeah,
a great, great manager for the Reds. I mean, they were fortunate to get him when they did.
Quite a character. I mean, he treated 25 guys 25 different ways, you know. They always say, treat everybody the same way, and Sparky said, no. That's not how you get the best out of people. You find out what kind of people they are. You find out who needs a kick in the butt. You find out who needs a pat on the butt, and that's how you treat them.
And Sparky was not afraid to do any of those things, was he?
Either one. He knew how to do it.
Yeah, he was managing a pretty strong group of egos, too, I would imagine.
A massive group of egos. I mean, when you put into the clubhouse a Joe Morgan, a Pete Rose, a Tony Perez, a Johnny Bench, a George Foster. I mean, these guys, you know, had a right to have big egos, but Sparky knew how to put them in their place, and Tony Perez knew how to put them in their place to keep them deflated.
You know, Tony was a big influence in that clubhouse, wasn't he?
Tony was a huge influence in that clubhouse.
Yeah. And for the good.
Bob Housem did not know that. For some reason, did not know that Tony was actually the team leader. People didn't realize that because of the language barrier, and Tony was pretty quiet off the field. But if you were ever in the clubhouse and listened to him, if any of the other superstars started talking too much about their accomplishments, Tony would say, "Remember the day you struck out four times in a row? Get away with it."
Yeah.
And they traded him in 1977. The team immediately went downhill, and General Manager President Bob Housem said the worst thing that he ever did in his baseball career was trade Tony Perez.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because that was the beginning of the end.
That was the beginning of the end. They had no leader, and everybody started bailing out after that through free agency. And the Reds would not participate in free agency. That was Housem and Dick Wagner's decision. And by 1982, they were losing 101 games.
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up in Dayton. And, I remember as a kid reading Jim Ferguson, and then, you know, you took over the beat 1973. You came in, you couldn't have asked for a better time to come in as the beat writer of Cincinnati Reds.
No doubt about it. And it took me several years to realize that I didn't stop and smell the coffee or smell the roses of what I was seeing. Mm-hmm. I thought, hey, this is how it is all the time, you know? I was just very, very fortunate to see the best baseball team of all time. Even I'm not old enough to have covered the 27 Yankees, and you hear a lot about the 27 Yankees and the Philadelphia Athletics of the early 30s, which had some really good teams, but I just can't imagine a team being better than the 1975 and 76 Reds. No team could afford them now. Wow. Each one of those starting eight would probably be making over $20 million dollars a year in today's market.
I was going to say, free agency's pretty much made it impossible to put together a team, especially a small market team.
Never happen again.
Together. Right. Yeah. Now, you must really, five decades, you must really love your work to be at it as long as you have, Hal.
There are three things in life that I really love, other than my family and my wife. I love to write. I love baseball, and I love to travel. And for 50 years, I got to do all three. And I got paid for it. What more could you ask? I always told my wife, Nadine, that someday I was going to have to get a real job, but I never did. I never had to.
You didn't feel guilty now, did you?
Not a bit.
How many stadiums have you visited in your career?
52. With St. Louis, I got to see three. Cincinnati, I covered the last game in Crosley Field. I was a backup writer when they closed, when Crosley Field was in its heyday, but it closed in 1970, and I was there, so I got to see the last game in Crosley. I got to cover the first game in Riverfront, the last game in Riverfront, the first game in Great American. I won't make the last game in Great American. I'd like to, but I don't think I will.
Yeah. You know, over the last number of years, you've worked on with the eyesight problems mm-hmm. that you have now. I mean, you are legally blind.
Right.
And I've heard you tell this story before so many times about when that happened mm-hmm. and your encounter in the clubhouse with Aaron Boone. Could you tell us about that?
Absolutely. It's one of the greatest stories of my life. In 2002, I lost a vision in my right eye, mm-hmm. and it was a stroke of the optic nerve. And my ophthalmologist told me, there's good news and bad news about that. And I said, okay. He said, the bad news is that there's no treatment for strokes of the optic nerves. You'll never get better. You just have to hope it doesn't get worse. But the good news is, in only 15% of the cases does it happen in both eyes. Well, a year later, I got out of bed, and I couldn't see out of either eye very mm-hmm. well, and I told my wife I just hit the big 15%. Mm-hmm. So I went to my sports editor, and I said, I'm done. I'm finished. You know, I'm legally blind. I can't see. And he said, no, you're not done yet. You're going to spring training, and you're going to try it. So I was not very convinced that I should do it, but I did. Mm-hmm. Went to Sarasota, where the Reds trained, got to the airport, waited for my luggage, and my luggage was black like almost everybody else's. I couldn't find my luggage.
Yeah.
I had to wait until the carousel was empty, and I picked up my luggage, and I went to my condo and dropped my luggage and jumped in a taxi cab and went to the ballpark. And I walked into the clubhouse, and I stood at the door, and I looked around. My eyesight now, everything is dark and fuzzy. As we sit in this room, it's very dark, yeah. and both of your faces are very fuzzy.
Yeah.
And I'm told that's a good thing.
But that's actually the way we look at it.
Okay. And yeah, my wife tells me she looks like Marilyn Monroe because she knew I love Marilyn Monroe. Yeah. But anyway, I'm standing in the clubhouse looking around and seeing people that I have covered for years and years and not recognizing them. Mm-hmm. And Aaron Boone was playing third base at the time, saw me, I guess, and saw the perplexed look on my face and came up to me and said, what's wrong? And I said, you're probably seeing me for the last time. I'm out of here. And I told him why. And he grabbed me by the elbow and led me over to his seat in the clubhouse and said, you sit down right here. So I sat down, and he said, I don't ever want to hear you say the word quit again. You love your job. You're good at your job. Everybody in this room will be willing to help you. And that turned me around that day. Mm-hmm. I was going to go home. I was going to quit.
Yeah.
And, that's 12 years ago, and Aaron Boone was on the Hall of Fame ballot this year. Aaron Boone is not a Hall of Famer,
yeah.
but he's a Hall of Famer in my heart.
Yeah, definitely.
He got one vote for the Hall of Fame, and you know where that came from, because the guy turned my life around for me.
Have you always gotten that kind of great support from the Reds players through your career?
Yes, very much. Sean Casey was very good about it. And fortunately, I've learned to get around pretty well, and a lot of the younger players, I'm told, don't even realize that I'm legally blind.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of the veterans know about it, and nobody ever mentions anything, but every once in a while somebody will say something that I know they know about it. But after Aaron Boone did that, I know he turned it into kind of a comedy act. He told somebody one day that he saw me talking to a Coke machine. And when I would come into the clubhouse during the season, he would start jumping up and down, waving his arms and say, Hal, I'm over here. So,
but that was Aaron Boone is a class guy.
He is a class yeah. act, absolutely yep. a class yeah. act. I mean, he was a class act before he did that for me.
Right.
And it did not surprise me that he would do something like that. And
yeah,
he will not take credit. He claims he doesn't remember that story when people ask him about it, but I don't know how he could forget it, because I'll never forget it.
You know, another class act you write about in your book, Eric Davis.
My all-time favorite player.
Great player, great person too, isn't he?
Absolutely the greatest. We remain friends to this day, and he still works for the Reds as a minor league roving instructor, and I see him in spring training, and the first day he walks up and gives me a big hug. But my grandson is named Eric, and my son named him after Eric Davis, because I used to take my oldest son to spring training, and Eric took him aside, played catch with him, gave him baseballs and gloves, and gave him one of his big black bats, and my kid was about 10 years old at the time, and we went home, and his first Little League game, I look up, and he's walking to home plate dragging this big black bat behind him. He's going to use this bat. Eric is
I mean, you said in the book he was not only the best baseball player that you've ever seen, but the best human being.
Best human being.
Is it that makes him that best human being?
I never have heard him say a bad word about anybody.
Right. He's had plenty of opportunities.
He could have.
Time. I mean, even when Marge Schott did him wrong, he did not speak out against her at all, and they eventually made up. But I mentioned this in the book. The one story in my career that I regret writing involved Eric Davis. The Reds were talking to the Phillies about trading him. And I had a source with the Phillies, and I called this person, and he said, well, we're not interested in Eric Davis because we hear he's on drugs. Well, stupidly, without getting any other sources on it, I wrote it that he won't be traded because the Phillies are worried he's on drugs. And that crushed Eric, absolutely crushed him. And he called me aside, and we talked it out, didn't yell at me, didn't scream, talked it out, and I apologized, and later on in his career, when he was involved with his own cancer issues, he wrote a book. And I thought, oh, boy, here we go. And I read his book, and in two or three places he said some very nice things about me. And he never once mentioned the story that I tried to wreck his career, actually, and never held that against me. That's the kind of guy he is.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation with Hal McCoy. One of the things that I think is kind of funny is you started covering sports back when both UD and Xavier had Division I football teams.
Yes.
And that's kind of hard to believe. To this day, Hal, my favorite T-shirt is the one that says Xavier football, undefeated since 1974, I think was the last year they actually played Division football at all there. So that's been quite a career. You've covered a lot of things, haven't you?
I covered some very good Dayton Xavier football games. And,
hard to believe.
Very hard to believe.
Beaujon Field.
At Beaujon Field, exactly, exactly. And, some really, really good times. And right now his name escapes me. The last coach with Xavier, Ed.
It escapes me, too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Anyway. Great story about that. I wish I could remember his name. It's in the book, and I can't. Well, I'm 74 years old. I can't remember what I had for breakfast. Yeah. But
I'm 55. I can't remember what I had for breakfast.
Yeah,
so don't worry about it.
Right.
So
the Dayton and Xavier were in a very close game toward the end of the game. Xavier scores a winning touchdown. Our photographer at the Dayton Daily News on the last play of the game took an overview of the field and of the play. Xavier had 12 men on the field.
Oops.
And got away with it. And I wrote about it and made a big issue out of it. And the coach at Xavier never admitted that it was done on purpose or anything. But when I made the Hall of Fame, he wrote me a little nice note, and he signed it the 12th man theme.
have seen so much in baseball and so much in Reds baseball. I mean, you've seen the bad years, the dark years, 1982,
right,
which had to be a torturous year to cover a team.
When I saw the other side.
I realized what I had seen before,
right.
And probably, I'm sure, gained an appreciation for what you had seen earlier in your career.
Right.
Your friend, my friend, Marty Brenneman, always says that, in the years that he has covered, done the Reds broadcast, the 1990 team is his favorite.
Mine too.
Okay.
Mine too.
Tell me why. Why is that?
That team was not expected to do anything.
Yeah.
Maybe predicted to finish second because that's where it finished five previous years under Pete Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And, the fact that the way they did it and the characters that were on that team, the Nasty Boys, it was just a very, very fun team to cover. There was something happening every day, especially with Lou Piniella managing.
Yeah.
And the Nasty Boys. And
Marty says the chemistry was so good.
Unbelievable.
On that team.
Unbelievable. It was one for one, or one for all and all for one. It was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And That team got into several fights, and when it did, it was 25-man in, man. There was nobody standing outside.
Let's talk with Mitch. I think, Mitch, are you in Dayton or Cincinnati? I can't tell from the screen here.
I live in Cincinnati now, but I'm from Dayton.
Okay, originally. I got you.
That's well, like me, yes.
Welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you very much. I would just like to say that being from Dayton, and I think I can speak for virtually every Daytonian my age and younger, and I'm 58, is we felt blessed. The Dayton Daily News had, we thought, the two best, you know, you can't even call them sports writers. They were gentlemen sports journalists.
Yeah.
In Hal and in the late Cy Burek. We were really blessed. We didn't know it. You know, we thought every town had great people like that. Turns out they don't. But I just want to thank you and say it's been an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to read your columns.
Thank you, Mitch. I appreciate Thanks, that. And I learned everything I know from Cy Burek. So he was my mentor, along with an old sports writer in Cincinnati who worked for the Cincinnati Post named Earl Lawson, who was is also in the Hall of Fame and was on the beat when I was a kid starting out. And he took me under my wing. And actually, the first day he saw me, he said, "Kid, keep your mouth shut, follow me, do what I do, and listen to what I say and what I do." And I did that. I followed her around for a year and hardly said a word to anybody. But Cy was my mentor.
And I'm going to tell you this, Hal, because I've been around the press box enough to know. I've seen another generation of baseball writers do the same thing with you, kind of follow you around and follow your lead.
It's very complimentary, and there's a reason for that. Because of what Cy and Earl did for me, mm-hmm. I always said to myself that any young writer that I saw that I could help, give them any advice, and if they came to me, I was going to do it because I would have been lost without Cy and without Earl. And I've tried to do that throughout my career, and it's been very, very satisfying that a lot of the writers in the next generation have thanked me for doing that and, you know, thanked me for helping them.
Hal, when you started out, did you ever expect to have Hall of Fame attached to your name?
Never. When I was growing up as a poor kid in Lakemore, Ohio, I just hoped I would be able to survive in life. And it was a dream come true when I became the baseball writer. And I thought, you know, I'd reach the epitome then. But, of course, to have my peers elect me to the Hall of Fame is the epitome. It's the highlight of my career.
Well, it's interesting, your book, too. You mentioned Pete Rose in the book, and the thing that impressed you most about him, that caught my attention. You weren't impressed with his hit record. You were impressed with something else, weren't you?
You have to refresh my memory.
The hit streak.
Hit streak.
Oh, the hit streak. Yeah, absolutely.
That was more impressive than the number of hits.
Yeah, the number of hits, you know, he's a great hitter and had to be a great hitter to do that. But it was over a course of, you know, 20-some years. So it was a matter of just accumulating hits and accumulating hits. But to put together a 44-game hitting streak, that's very, very special. You have to get at least one hit every game. And I know there was one game where he made an out in the ninth inning and hadn't had a hit, and the team went extra innings, and he got a hit in extra innings. And a couple of times he had to drop a bunt or to get a hit in his last at-bat. And the thing that really impressed me about him was how he handled it. He had great stories after every game when the hit streak continued. He just entertained the sporting world with his comments. And he had to be under a lot of pressure, but, you know, the pressure brought out the best in Pete, always.
Yeah, we've got the new baseball commissioner coming in, so there's a renewed push for Pete to go into the Hall of Fame. What's your take on that?
Unfortunately, I do not think that Pete is going to be reinstated. Rob Manfred, the new commissioner, is doing what he has to do, and that's accept his request for reinstatement to consider it. But Manfred and Bud Selig, his predecessor, are joined at the hip. They're great friends, and I just think that Rob is just going to carry on what Bud did. I think that he'll talk to Pete, and that request for reinstatement will lay on his desk for the next 10 years like it did with Bud.
So what's going on is just a formality right now.
It's a formality, absolutely.
You said one thing in the book about Pete, that if he had immediately admitted his mistakes, apologized, and shown remorse, that he might have got a year.
He'd be in the Hall of Fame right now. He probably would have got a year suspension. and had been back in the game. And but then, you know, that's Pete. You know, we were talking about the egos, and to be Pete Rose, he had to have the ego that he had. And I'm sure he thought he was a Teflon man, that he was Pete Rose. And even though it said right there on the door, Rule 21C, if you bet on baseball and get caught, you're banned for life. He had to see it every day, but he didn't think that he would ever get caught or they would have the guts to ban a Pete Rose from the game. But I'll never forget the first day of spring training in 1989 when he was standing by himself out on a field. And I walked over to him, and he said, "How are you? You're not going to see me for a couple of days." And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Well, Commissioner Peter Ubroth wants to talk to me, wants me to ask my opinion on a few things." And
I thought,
why would the commissioner take a manager away from spring training, the first week of spring training, to ask his opinion? Couldn't he do it on the telephone?
And to kick him out.
Yeah.
Yep. And Hal, we've run out of time, unfortunately. Thank you so much. It's really great to see you.
Very good.
Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate you having me on. Enjoyed it.
Good.
Stay tuned for Science Friday, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.